opinions expressed on the Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, the Kevin Smith Show, Jerry Wills, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Welcome to the Kevin Smith Show with Jerry Wills. That's me. And I've taken over Kevin's show all this week while he is on a big adventure someplace. I'm sure he'll tell you all about it when he gets back. And, well, we wish him all the best in his efforts and that his journey is a pleasant one. Sorry about the opening of the show. Once again, Gremlins. It's just crazy, I'll tell you. I've been working on this now for, I don't know, probably, 5 hours, trying to get this exactly tweaked right. Everything was working. 10 minutes before the show, I restarted the system, and it worked again. So I put it on pause, I clicked, and then you saw what happened. Oh well, that's the way it goes. Sometimes in electronics, in that world, you just end up with things that never really work out the way they're supposed to. And I'm sure if you have electronics in your home that you know exactly what I'm talking about. Now, last night, I told you we were going to have a special guest on. If you were watching, you're probably expecting this person to really, well, let's just say, part the seas. I think that what you're going to find is that she is going to absolutely rock your boat. And I'm talking, of course, about my next guest. I'm looking. Her name is D.M. Murdoch. I can't really pronounce the name. Acharya S. We'll ask her when she comes on exactly how that's pronounced. She has written quite a number of books. She has information that I have read through quite a few times and just found it to be fascinating material. So, you know, I'm not going to spill the beans just yet. When we get her online, we're going to have her tell you a little bit about herself. She basically... aside from being an author, there was a catchword Kathy gave me. What was that, Kathy?
I don't remember.
Oh, come on. That's Kathy. Even behind the camera, she draws a blank. Let's see.
Arco-theology.
What was that?
Arco-theology.
That's why I couldn't remember it. I haven't used that word in a while. Her books include The Christ Conspiracy, Sons of God, Krishna, Buddha, and Christ Unveiled, Who Was Jesus, Fingerprints of the Christ, Christ in Egypt, The Horus-Jesus Connection, and others. I mean, she's got just several here on the plate right in front of me. So I know you're going to find this interesting. And you're probably wondering, why are we going in a direction that is seemingly religious? Well, we're not. And that's the whole point of this. It isn't. What this is are some details that you probably have never heard before. And there are things, not everything, of course, because I'm going to learn something tonight just like you. But there are things that I have heard about, and I thought you would do well to be exposed to it. We're heading out to the next break. As soon as we get back from this break, we're going to have her on. And I promise you, D.M. Murdoch is going to rock your boat. All right, let's see if this break works. See you on the other side. And, well, as you noticed, the video clip didn't work either, so I don't feel like messing with it. I guess we won't have commercials tonight. So, without any further ado, let's bring our guest on, and let's find out more. I'm excited about this, and I hope you are too, because I have a feeling that the information you're about to hear is going to cause you to sit down and go, huh, how about that? Alrighty. Are you there?
I am. Hello, how are you?
Hi, doing fine. Let me make a couple of adjustments, bring your volume up.
Okay. Testing 1, 2, 3, hello.
Alrighty. Well, we'll see if that works. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, I can hear you. You look quiet too. Interesting connection we got here.
Well, there are really interesting things that happen around here. When Kevin does the show normally, it's just anyone's guess what's going to happen next. A lot of the subjects he covers, he caused alphabet agencies to pull the plug on him.
Oh, really?
I wouldn't have believed that, but I found out for my own self. So, anyway, I was just telling folks about you just before the show and letting them know, you know, what an exciting night this is going to be. Naming off several of your books, and excuse me. What I want to start with, basically, is just to kind of lay a couple of ideas out there, because I know from having read through your material that you've got information that just causes some folks to just turn around and walk away. Am I right about that?
Well, I suppose we all have that. I have some information like that because we tell other people.
But
let's put it this way. What I do is delve into cherished beliefs, and so I find what I think is the real meat underneath them, and some people are afraid of the meat and they run away.
Well, yeah, exactly right. And that's, you know, it doesn't matter what subject matter you're discussing. It can be ghosts, reincarnation, UFOs, lost cities. And you're right, when you start pegging a few things, when you find out for yourself that something is right and other people haven't quite got to the point where they would accept it, then yeah, they're going to turn around and go, ah, there's something wrong with that one. But I've read through your material, and it's thrilling. It really is. It is for me, anyway. And what I wanted
very
to do...
Very cosmic.
I'm sorry?
Very cosmic.
Yeah, it is. It seems to go beyond the normal boundaries of time and space, at least for me.
It does. It transcends cultures. It transcends eras. It transcends just borders, boundaries, and limitations. Gets rid of gender, all the sexist rubbish on the planet that's associated with religion. Everything, all the neuroses and pathologies that are associated with religion, it's all transcended when you realize what the longest period of worship in history has been all about.
And yes.
When you were actually, I heard your intro, and you were talking about how this show is usually about UFOs and other phenomena, and here we are talking about religion, and yet these subjects actually do dovetail when you discover, not necessarily UFOs, but just the general celestial canopy and drama in front of us is explainable by our religious ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're looking up at the heavens, you're actually seeing what a large percentage of religious ideation on the planet has been about all along. And that's all I reveal.
And
it may be shocking, but it's shocking in a good way.
I think so. I think that the shocking aspect of it is what's necessary to wake people up.
Yeah, it's like a cold shower, but then it's followed by a warm bath.
Mm-hmm.
And the warm bath doesn't go away. It's around you all the time. And so once you get past that cold shower and you connect to your surroundings in the reality that has been painted for us over the past many thousands of years by human culture, then it is a thrilling thing. It's very exciting. I'm talking about what we might call nature worship.
Mm-hmm.
But the viewpoint I take with religions is very anthropological. I'm observing from the outside. I'm not involved in it. I'm not interested in beliefs and having them, I have other people follow them. I don't have any cockamamie stuff that I talk about, like you have to wear a certain hat or jump on one leg or chant some nonsensical glossolalia. But you can develop an appreciation for our natural surroundings, extending into every direction. It doesn't have to be finite. I'm not talking about going up necessarily and hugging a tree. I'm talking also about just the experience of investigating the cosmos. And this is the same perspective that the ancients had when they would look up at the sky, both the day and night skies, in total awe and wonder and perception that there was some kind of divine being behind it all. And so they associated that sensation of awe, wonder, reverence, divinity to the natural surroundings.
Mm-hmm.
And it gave them tremendous respect for the natural world in the first place. They used to have sacred groves that you could get the death penalty, capital punishment for cutting down.
I know there's something like that in South America right now. There's a stand of trees that the locals believe are a gift from God. These trees produce a red sap called Sangre de Grado, and it's the most potent in the entire jungle, from what I've been told. And you can't go there. You can't harvest those trees. You won't walk out of there alive.
Well, you can't say that you can blame them. If the trees have tremendous value going in many different directions, for example, the sacred groves that were cut down in Europe led to horrible chaos, people running out of wood, and here too, in the United States, all over the world. You know, when you cut down, I mean, look at, what is it, Easter Island, when they cut down the trees there. Cannibalism ensues. It's a big mess. So there's an understandable reason for people to protect their natural world, because we've seen droughts and famines and chaos and warfare and everything else goes on. We're going to have all these problems coming across all the time now, because we're running out of water, clean water all over the world. And this is why this information becomes even more important, that we connect again with this reverence for our natural world, and not keep cutting down everything and polluting everything and destroying our sacred forests and everything else that we need to live on the planet.
Well, I see very little that's held sacred with most folks anymore, at least as I've traveled through the world. You know, the trees, I mean, they plant parks because it looks nice. But if there's something that, like a sacred grove, it wouldn't have any relevance, because the laws, the needs, and so forth, they don't pay attention to sacred things. But
this is why there's another aspect to this whole thing that's our experience of it, which is if you're having a happy life, you're less inclined to be destructive. And so if we can look at our natural world in a different way, as the ancients did, We don't have to go and propitiate gods by doing ridiculous things like the Aztecs and the Maya were doing, or any other culture on the planet that has committed, you know, absurd, horrible atrocities in the name of God. And there have been, the history is full of them in all directions, atrocities, genocide, mass rape in the name of religion. Yeah, nobody's talking about following any kind of nature worshiping in that direction. Just the perception. I'll give you an example. Just go up for a walk. If you're lucky, you can live near some woods and a mountain, perhaps, and you go for a walk up the mountain, surrounded by trees, breathing the fresh air, smelling the various odors from the plants, and hearing sounds of birds and bees and the wind blowing through the trees, and the sun is shining, and let's say it's a 72-degree day.
Mm-hmm.
The sensation that you get from that, I do anyway, is very healing. It gives me a raison d'etre. It makes me excited about being on the planet.
Same for me.
So I'm really just talking about having a total experience on planet Earth. You don't need to do anything special about it. Just having a happy perception of reality. And this will change people's behavior towards the natural environment, hopefully. And knowing that our ancients gave themselves permission to feel alive and in awe and in wonder of their surroundings. And so we find that with that perception of awe, just again, imagine yourself, let's say 10,000 years ago, sitting on top of a hill, nothing hopefully dangerous around you, because there are an awful lot of dangers in the natural world, wild animals and all manner of storms and whatnot that didn't have adequate protection from. We don't even today, but imagine that you're sitting there and you can be peaceful, and there's a wonderful, clear night, and you can see all the stars in front of you, and just the feeling of being alive in this sort of primordial world. Everything's clean and clear and pristine, and the grass is fresh and growing. It's not dead. It's just are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, sorry. Okay, I just got a buzz. Somebody's buzzing in.
All right, that's fine. Anyway. I was lost in the idea of sitting on top of this hill.
I wanted to give you a moment of silence to reflect and take it all in.
That was perfect.
You know, I do that when I'm reading about archaeological sites.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been reading about archaeological sites and even dug in a couple for the last several decades.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm getting old enough now that I can say things like that. It's pretty cool. But when I'm seeing one that's being described, let's say, for example, this site, Chateau Hoyuk in Turkey, and then there's one even older now. It's called Göbekli Tepe in also in Turkey. Incredible site.
Mm-hmm.
This oldest one, Göbekli Tepe, is this massive, they haven't even begun to uncover this. It was buried over about 8,000 years ago. It was first built 11,600 years ago or so. And it's a temple site. There's no way around it. They're saying this is one of the earliest, if not the earliest, expressions of religion, organized expressions in the world that we have so far. I mean, I'm sure that they extend back further than that, but this was buried deliberately, just a couple thousand years after it was built, and it was preserved. And it's amazing, the carvings of the stones, very delicate and refined. There's a number of different species of animals and some depictions of humans, and the site goes on and on for acre after acre and acre, and circular buildings that look like Stonehenge in a sense, but they're even more refined.
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking 12,000 years ago this is going on. And what I do is try to trace what possible cultural artifact, religious cultural artifact, I can find at these sciencey sites. I always feel this projection, like I go back there. I would love so much to have a time machine and be able to go back to a site like that and see it being constructed and what it was used for and the surroundings. That sort of pristine world that is really quite wild still and unpolluted and untamed. The dramatic lighting, because you had firelight. So there's that flickering going on at night with the flames in your walls throwing shadows on them. And then you have the dark sky and then the sun rising in the morning. And if you put yourself into this position and you start thinking about what someone would develop as religious ideation based on such an experience, then you can start relating to the material that I'm bringing to light. You'll say, well, look, it's quite obvious why someone would develop a fire cult. And when I use the word cult, I'm using it in an anthropological manner here.
Right.
It can be used pejoratively, and I do that as well when I call something a cult. If somebody's trying to, like, you can imagine I get some flack about this subject matter. And so when people are trying to, like, try to convince me that their particular religion is correct, and they get aggressive,
mm-hmm.
which they often do, and try calling me names, all this other stuff, I'll say something like, look, you can't suck me into your cult. Okay, so
I tell them I'm not really into joining any exclusive clubs.
Yeah, that's a little softer than what I'm saying. but they get very aggressive with sexist remarks and misogynistic comments and trying to bash me, bludgeon me into behaving like a good little woman.
And you don't do that?
It's never worked on me.
You're not a good little woman, then.
I have always been a genderless consciousness in a female vessel. So even as a child, I did not accept limitations based on my gender.
You would get along very well with Kathy. She sounds exactly like you as the way you're portraying this.
Yeah, I was just thinking today that I was one of the few people when I was a child who stood up.
We've got a break coming up. Stand by, all right? Let's pick this up on the other side. Folks, that took me by surprise. I was completely into what we were talking about. Well, don't go away, because there's going to be a few very keenly interesting things that you're going to find out about in a few minutes. Well, we're back, folks. Let's bring her back on. Oh, you should have seen the look on my face. Well, maybe you did. Kathy came in just laughing at me. I guess that what happened is that the volume, I hit it with my hand. And when the break music came in, it was like an explosion in my ears. So it just completely surprised me. That'll be good for the archives. Before we get started again, I want to ask you, how do you pronounce your name? How do you pronounce
it? You actually got it right.
Did I?
Yeah, Acharya.
Acharya. Okay, perfect. Well, I didn't want to butcher it. And people call me Jerry Willis or Jerry Wells, and there's nothing wrong with that. But it isn't my name. So I wanted to make sure that I had this specific and proper for you.
Well, that is a pseudonym. So it doesn't really belong to me. It's just a title mm-hmm. I took on to be mischievous.
How did you come up with this?
Well, I have two cultures that I love. Well, more than that, actually. Greece is one of my favorite cultures in the world, but I also love the Greek culture. I also love Swedish culture and Indian culture, among others. I like to study the whole planet. Mm-hmm. And beyond. But so I took on a title, Acharya, which is an Indian word. It means teacher. And I knew that it would ruffle a few feathers in the strict Orthodox fundamental Hindu group. So, and it has, it has. But it's also a very common Indian last name, so yeah, nobody needs to get their nose bent out of shape. I used it as a pseudonym because when I first went online, I was concerned about the reaction to the information I've been digging up. We haven't even gotten into the real nitty-gritty of it.
Oh, I know, and we should, because this is what I was excited for everyone to have a chance at hearing about from you. So let's go down the line of books you have. How many are there? 3, 5, 7 seven books so far. Are you writing more?
Oh, gosh, yes. The first book I published is called The Christ Conspiracy, The Greatest Story Ever Sold. And that was published in 1999. And that one kicked up quite a bit of trouble. The premise of this book is to show that, now this is where people get shocked, that the New Testament character called Jesus Christ was not a single person, but a composite of both human beings, those are the people who said the sayings, and some of the characters in the New Testament obviously have historical reality. But much of the gospel tale itself is not literal, which means that it's allegorical as well as fictional and mythical. So I pretty much lay out that case that we're talking about a mythical figure.
Well, that's interesting. So what about all the paintings and, the, you know, all, and there, you don't do any church, and there's a guy hanging on a cross, and the Shroud of Turin. I mean, everything in our culture in America seems to have a direct affiliation with some aspect of Jesus somewhere in the mix, whether it's the Constitution, the dollar bill, you know, the Lord's Prayer. I mean, everything kind of funnels down. Jesus is the one. And you're saying that Jesus didn't exist? Or
yes, we are a Jesus-permeated culture. Hold on just a second. Okay, so anyway, yes, in this particular part of the world, something like 80% of the populace identifies itself as Christian.
Right.
So, and I was raised a Christian. Born and raised. In fact, my Christian roots go back to the Puritans who landed in 1630, the Winthrop fleet. My mother's side of the family is direct descendant from one of the Winthrops, my mother's father, the Winthrop fleet passengers. So, we were religious proselytizers.
Wow.
Especially, specifically Christian religious proselytizers. Because these the pilgrims got here, they weren't necessarily only escaping persecution in England. They were actually told, when they sent back to England, they told this next group of people who came, they solicited them to proselytize to the Native Americans. This bunch of heathen, we need people to come to the New World and proselytize.
Kind of like the Mormon missionaries now.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and so many other groups.
Yeah.
But people don't realize that. It wasn't just persecution. They were actually coming here to proselytize as missionaries, and so that's who I'm descended from. A significant amount of my genetics. And some of my genetics are also Swedish. That's one of the reasons why I like Swedish culture so much. I like the mythology too, and there's some connection to Christianity with that mythology as well. And what I show in my books, practically all of them to some extent, is that there are preceding mythical motifs that have been used to create the Christ character. And so, as shocking as it might sound, if the more you know about religion dating back thousands of years, the less shocking it is, actually.
Right.
Because you'll find that when the Christian myth, I'm going to call it, was formulated all around the Mediterranean, there had been brotherhoods and religious affiliations and temples and churches. Well, there actually were churches. They were called ecclesia before Christianity. They were, until the Jews were involved in them, they weren't as religious, but like in Greece, for example, they were just assemblies. The word ecclesia just means assembly. But there were these organizations all around the Mediterranean and different religions, sects, cults. And in fact, there was a very well-trod path, two paths to India, two major ones. One was over land, which was not preferable for, you know, bringing goods into the Roman Empire, but the other one was through overseas, through the Red Sea.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were ports all along it. And on the other side, of course, is Arabia. So we have India, Arabia, Egypt, and then into the Mediterranean. And there was a tremendous amount of cultural exchange going on at that point. This path had been opened up quite fully by the first century. And the first century BCE, the Romans had already established a trade route to India.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was all this cultural exchange going on, and you had this major, massive port in Alexandria, Egypt, where all the texts that were coming in on ships were being confiscated, copied, and sometimes the copy was returned, and the original was placed into the Library of Alexandria.
Mm-hmm.
So up to maybe 500,000, possibly more, of these texts. Scrolls, mostly, because the actual book codex form didn't come into popularity until the 2nd, 3rd centuries. But so you had these scrolls, 500,000 scrolls in the Library of Alexandria.
Wow.
And the university there was populated by people from all over the known world. I would suspect that along the Silk Road, you had also contact with China, and so there would possibly even be Asians, not Near Easterners, not Indians, but all the way into China. Certainly there were Indians coming and going. Now, it's a hard trek, obviously. No, there weren't tons of people necessarily ending up in the Mediterranean area, but there were Indians there as well.
You say that there was, let's clarify this for everyone, that there wasn't a specific Jesus, but there were several who were part of the character that was morphed into one. Is that right?
Yeah, composite figure, but they weren't several Jesuses. They weren't named that.
Well, no.
That the word means healer. So there would be a Joshua figure,
mm-hmm.
that, based on the Old Testament character, who was very much a savior and a messiah especially to the northern kingdom people, the Israelites,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to the Judeans in the south.
What would make a person, in the eyes of the people, appear to be a Jesus figure? What would their accomplishments be?
Oh, a real person?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you're talking about Joshua, and I'm sure there are others. I'm just wondering, you know, what is it that these folks did that gave them such a high standing that they were composited into one?
But I think of Joshua as a fictional character, so I'm not talking about a real person who had these qualities, any kind of qualities, but again, if you're talking about India, you probably have heard all kinds of stories out of India about yogis and gurus and masters and doing magic tricks called siddhis, mm-hmm. and in Tibet and Nepal, and Buddhist miracles and all that. If you've heard these stories, then you can imagine that someone going from, say, Greece to India would be fascinated by this as well and would be interested in trying to develop these skills. So there's this path being worn of people. They have the stories of, say, Pythagoras going to India in the 5th century B.C., and studying with the Indians and learning about metempsychosis, which is the Greek word for reincarnation, and other sort of religious teachings and spiritual miracles and so forth, and whether or not they actually were being done, if there really were miracles, is a whole other debate, but certainly there are magic tricks, and people would be doing those. That's a long lineage of what they call fakirs in India that do these things with ashes and fire, and they look like they're miracles, and the people who have less education, shall we say, might perceive them as being miracles coming from God. They don't. It's like watching some of these modern magicians, like David Blaine or Chris Angel. If you just can't figure it out, you might believe these are true. I watched it and said, wow, this stuff is incredible. These guys are like, you know, Jesus supposedly was, right?
Sure.
And so in antiquity, people were doing these kinds of things too. And they carried around little bags of medicinal substances. They were considered to be healers. We have entire guilds of people such as healers, a healing guild. We have the guilds of antiquity, say carpenters and masons and healers or physicians, undertakers, you know, some kind of police force. There certainly were army, not guilds, but let's say sects. The military had their own gods. They all had their own gods. They all had their own religion and spirituality entwined in them, in masonry. In carpentry, there is a carpenter guild with a carpenter god. There's, like I said, there was one of the first concepts was fire as a divinity because it brought so much to humanity.
And they made idols and worshipped it, and it became deified at that point.
We had a fire god.
Yeah, exactly. Now we call it Zippo.
Because it was so hard to start fires too then. Now we take it for granted. But you had to really call on everything around you just to get a fire going, you know.
Well, we've got another break coming up. Stay on the line. Folks, don't go away. We'll be back right after these messages. Well, we're back, everyone. Thanks for waiting. I know it was a little bit of a long break. The affiliates, we picked up several new affiliates the past few weeks, and they all have their requirements. So, consequently, with those requirements, we have to oblige them and give them time to do their local station identification, news, weather updates, and whatever. So that's the reason for it, in case you were wondering. I have the cheat sheet here. Kevin left it for me. So we are talking with Acharya S. And we're just scratching the surface, really. And I'd like to really get down deep into a couple of subjects with you. The, you know, taking, let's just take, I mean, there are several books here. Which one would you say is your favorite?
Well, the one that continues to be read most extensively is probably the Christ Conspiracy. So it's like having children. You can't really say which one is your favorite, you know?
Yeah, I do. It was a loaded question.
It did. Every one has a different overall theme. And I followed up the Christ Conspiracy with a book called Sons of God, Krishna, Buddha, and Christ Unveiled, where I went into what this really is all about. We touched briefly on some of the, what are called astro-theological aspects of the religions of the Mediterranean at the time when Christianity was being formulated. And now astro-theology, of course, means astro stars. Theology is the study of God. So the combined word we are now using to refer to nature worship that applies largely or mainly to the sun, the moon, the stars, constellations, planets, including the earth and the natural phenomena on earth.
Mm-hmm.
And what you discover is that a tremendous amount of our religious worship and ideas and traditions and doctrines has been about astrotheology, has been astrotheological.
So this is basically, as far as religion goes, religious understanding started out as being as simple as fire worship, and it's grown into what it is today, which is a complete diffusion of what it started out from being. But does that mean necessarily that we're here alone without a God, or does it mean that we're here with a God that we have yet to identify?
Now we're getting into theology. Well,
I know.
I know people do get confused and think that if I say that Jesus Christ is a mythical figure, I'm claiming there's no God. But that's a whole different subject. And we can go into the various perceptions around the world of divinity. That would be another book that I've been working on for years and haven't done yet. And that's basically what do people perceive around the world in numerous cultures dating back thousands of years. There is an overarching being, monotheistic concept that dates back actually 7,000 or more years.
Mm-hmm.
From what we can tell. When you trace back, it's not just a matter of having texts from that period, obviously. You have to look at other markers from whatever cultural remains you find. And I would love to be able to go to some of these sites and poke my nose around because I have a different take on a lot of things. What I'm trying to do, basically, in the case of dating, going back thousands of years, of looking at these artifacts, the cultural artifacts, ruins, megalithic ruins, and so forth, is to find out what the story was that went with them. Mm-hmm. We find out that the ruins are astronomically aligned, often, to the sun, the moon, phases of the moon, other stars. Orion is a big one. That's actually a constellation. The three stars in the belt of Orion are very significant in ancient mythology in Egypt. The star Sirius was also very important in Egypt. And of course, it depends on where you are. You take a basic mythos about, say, something that we can all see around the world, like the sun,
mm-hmm.
It's going to develop somewhat differently, this myth. Them developed somewhat differently in, say, Mesoamerica, Central America, Mexico, and so forth, than it's going to be in Japan or in the northern region as opposed to the southern region, hemispheres. So what you discover when you start digging around is this general kind of mythos that has many different expressions, different flavors. In that same way, you also come across this sort of monotheistic concept. I call it monotheistic polytheism. It's the strangest idea. But there's a gigantic over-being that is that unites the whole cosmos. And you could call that the Creator. And then numerous or countless expressions of divinity from that one source. In the Egyptian religion, for example, you had all these gods and goddesses, but eventually they all resolve to the same one. And they take on each other's attributes, and they merge, and they meld, and they're interchangeable, and they're discussed in one breath, the same different epithets. So it all becomes like epithets, numerous epithets are names for the one divine being. Hmm. And you find this kind of concept in Indian religion as well. India has a very ancient spiritual tradition.
Yeah, they certainly do. You know, one of the things that I remember in a conversation I had with Kevin is that there are so many similarities in the birth myth, or the birth story, let's say, of Jesus and Buddha. His mother was Maya, and Jesus' mother was Mary, and there was the virgin birth, and, you know, yada, yada, yada. There's a lot of different similarities there. It was almost a perfect overlay, if not perfect. And I was reading something, I think it was something that you'd written, that said that Mary, the word Mary, what was that word for?
Egyptian?
Possibly. But anyway,
it means beloved in Egyptian.
Okay. That's not it. But the entire construct of Jesus and Mary and Buddha and Maya, these things were overlaying. And I remember reading years ago that there were several stories like this all over the Middle East and perhaps all over the world, that there was this, you know, belief that it was true. And when I was looking through here on your books, on the list of books, Jesus as the Sun, S-U-N, throughout history, it reminded me of Jay Widener and his video, Secrets of Alchemy. And in that, everything has to do with the sun, the planets, the stars, astronomy, basically, and probably astrology, to where everything is in place, it has markers, and everything is calculated from that. And I'm certainly no expert on it. But what we're finding in South America are so many places that are very precisely aligned, as you would find throughout the world. And the sun is one of those items that figures very heavily. As a matter of fact, you know, as you probably well know, the Inca were the the sun gods. They were the embodiment of the sun god on earth. And the sun was the god, just like it was for the Aztecs, for the Maya, and for so many other people. And what I'm wondering is, because our focus in Christianity is upon the Middle East, all the details coming to us are coming, theologically, are coming to us from that as a primary source. And I wonder how different the world might be had that source been a bit further this direction and south of the equator, how our theology might have been different, how it might have changed.
Well, the one good thing that Christianity was designed for, in my opinion, was to put an end to human sacrifice. I actually discussed this quite a bit in the book Sons of God, which is a pretty hefty book. I'm looking at it right now. It's 600 pages. So that's there's quite a lot of information in there about solar mythology in particular. That's why it's called Sons of God, S-U-N.
Mm-hmm.
And Buddha and Krishna and Jesus, my contention and what I seek to show in there, they are manifestations of the sun god mythos that extended all over the place. In fact, they seem to have been heavily formulated, not their origins, not Buddha and Krishna's origins, but around the same time when the Christ myth was being formulated, we start finding real concerted effort to write down the so-called biographies of Buddha and Krishna. It's very interesting,
mm-hmm.
all at the same time, in that first century period. But, the solar mythology and the human sacrifice, these actually go together, too, because the sun god was often sacrificed to that. The ancients believed the world would not go on if blood was not spilled, because I think they developed this morbidity from natural disasters and seeing that, look, if there's a god or gods and they're in charge of everything, they have some sort of supernatural powers, they are all-powerful, why are these horrible, horrible things always happening to us?
Mm-hmm.
Why the volcanic eruptions killing people? Why the horrible storms? Why earthquakes? All natural disasters. Why are these things happening if there's some good God in charge? Well, they must want something. Maybe we need to propitiate them. That's how it all started. Terrorized into it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there were other aspects of people thinking, well, we want to develop our own supernatural power, so we're gonna do it for this reason too, worshiping. We pray to the god he will bestow powers upon us. But this natural calamity that shook up the world every once in a while and slaughtered thousands of people made them believe that anybody who was in charge of this obviously wanted some blood. So in order to prevent future catastrophes, they start sacrificing someone. Droughts or another natural disaster, famine. And so in order to produce fecundity, fertility for the earth, to bring food to themselves, they thought, well, maybe we should sacrifice a human being. And this is still going on in some parts of the world. And it's going on in ways that we don't even perceive, actually. But there's really overt human sacrifice rituals. Now and again, you hear stories mm-hmm. in remote areas. But even as not so long ago as 100 years ago in India, there were actual human sacrifices being performed. And when you read their stories, you go, aha, this is pretty much the same thing you're reading in the New Testament. The guy is hung on a tree, possibly, because that's what they say about Jesus in Acts. He's hung on a tree.
Mm-hmm.
Or a tree that has a crossbar in it. That also happened in India as well as other places. If you want to hang someone up, the easiest thing to do is put a bar across through, thread it through some branches and tie them up like that.
Wow. So where does that leave us now? I mean, the information that you have in these books is extraordinary. But now here in the 21st century, doesn't it feel like there's nothing? Or do you feel like there's still some ray of hope that we might finally figure out what's going on and put aside, a belief system that doesn't really hold any reality?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I think we need to get beyond this divisiveness that is just totally destroying our planet. It's caused horrendous warfare and genocide and destruction of culture, like burning books and ruining temples and then even destroying great cathedrals and churches. I don't like seeing destruction of beautiful art.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to make sure that we actually can preserve our culture, our civilization, our humanity, we do need to transcend these religions that are not true, that are based on mummified mythology. And in order to do that, if we learned what they're really about, we would actually be on a much better path. Because what the ancients were trying to do in numerous instances was to convey information about the natural world. So if we had one purpose, for example, with the creation of Christianity, to end human sacrifice, which was basically the propitiation of gods that was being carried out all over the place. That's what we're seeing in there. We're seeing an archetypical sacred king human sacrifice ritual in the New Testament story of Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
He is crucified or killed to absolve us of our sins, sin removal. That scapegoat ritual, that dates back way before Christianity, probably 10,000 years or more. But we know definitely in the historical period that it was committed many times for the same reason. It's a scapegoat. You put all the sins of the village on the goat's head and then kill the goat.
Right.
And there was this proxy, human proxy, stand-in for the god. This could be the king or a proxy for the king, and he or she would be sacrificed as well for the same reason. And so now we know that that's all superstition and nonsense, and this is what Christian missionaries did in places like Mexico and Central America, was to tell them, okay, this is a once-for-all sacrifice. You don't need to do this anymore. It was already done for you. So in a sense, that was advanced technology.
Right.
You know, this particular myth that helped put an end to that widespread practice. And so we can look at that information being conveyed as a very ancient religious idea. But the other information that's conveyed is quite scientific. As you mentioned, South America, we are finding ruins that are astronomically aligned. We're finding these all over the world. They are cited often to the solstices. That's an easy one.
Mm-hmm.
The equinoxes, the sun rising on the cross-quarter days on each month.
Mm-hmm.
The first day of the month. Sometimes you find 12 and 13 stones that are aligned. Stonehenge has not only solar alignments, it has lunar alignments, lunar phases. And as I said before, you have alignments to Sirius and many other stars around the world in different parts where they were most visible. And people would live their lives around this. The rising of Sirius in Egypt, its commemoration had very practical reasons. When Sirius rose, they knew that the Nile was going to flood. The water would overflow its banks,
mm-hmm.
and deposit fertile earth for crops to be grown. And, of course, watering the dry desert area as well. And without that flood, the droughts would ensue and people would starve. So the Egyptians were very keen on keeping that cycle going. So not only did they observe the cycle and therefore encapsulate this knowledge in their myths, Osiris, for example, is the water of the Nile flooding the banks, and Isis is the banks. And the Negros is Horus, and the green that Osiris is portrayed as is the chlorophyll, is photosynthesis. So you have all of this information being conveyed in a very colorful story. And that's how you would teach children, for example, why you would devise these myths by personifying natural phenomena and celestial bodies. The sun is turned into a male often in our myths. There are also female, there are sun goddesses as well, like Amaterasu in Japan,
mm-hmm.
who emerges from the cave in December. Okay, so this is the rebirth in December is part of solar mythology. The sun
is
coming back to life after its long journey into the underworld. And so this kind of information is what's being conveyed here. And if anything happened to civilization, we would need this basic information. It's how we set our calendars. It's how we do our harvesting and planting. We have so much dependence on knowing the cycles of the celestial bodies, the sun, the moon, and the stars, that's what these myths represent. And if we keep telling these stories as myths that represent that ultimate meaning, then we can ensure that our future generations have this vital information.
Well, do you have an idea or a thought? What Kathy and I do, we search around through South America because there's so much that hasn't been found. Mm-hmm. And what we're looking for is evidence of a civilization, you know, a worldwide, hopefully, civilization that existed a long time ago before some global cataclysm struck. Mm-hmm. And what you were just saying gives me reason to think, you know, if something did happen to the world in a large way, this kind of information would be useful, maybe. What do you think? Could it be that, you know, an ancient civilization, the survivors of that civilization brought that information forward because that was the most arcane of the information mm-hmm. that was available to them?
Yeah, I would say absolutely. You have these stories of the catastrophes, and now we know that the end of the Quaternary, that there was tremendous flooding, not in 1 year, in a period of time, depending on where you are, but we also know that the majority of humankind has lived around water, of course, a water source, and if it's not an inland river of some significance, then it's the coast with mm-hmm. the oceans. So with that flooding, what has been buried? There are many stories about what has been sunk under the ocean, mm-hmm. the seas that have risen with all that, end of the glaciation and so forth. And there's no reason to necessarily think that humanity 10,000 years ago was not advanced in many ways. Now, we already know this. We have this astonishing site mm-hmm. in Turkey, Göbekli Tepe, that is so advanced, and no one had any idea that humanity had built anything remotely resembling that long ago, 12,000 years ago. Okay, so if they could do it then, they could have done it 10,000 years before that. Now, that, of course, depends a lot on geography. Mm-hmm. And we're finding much out about how culture could have developed depending on not only geography, where you also have not just places that are remote and inaccessible, but climatic changes that will dramatically alter the environment. For example, we have the Sahara was, 10,000 or more years ago? It was a lush forest, tropical yeah. forest. And certainly there were human beings wandering around in that lush tropical rainforest. Mm-hmm. Because we have humanity already in Africa for, it depends on what hominid you're talking about, but Homo sapiens sapiens, the date of the emergence of this particular species with the large cranium that can produce geniuses, is being pushed back to 200,000 years ago. So when I was growing up studying anthropology, it was about 30,000 years ago.
Right.
Then a couple decades I started hearing about 100,000 years ago. Now they're saying 200,000 years ago. And then, of course, even some other hominids that were not, you know, totally primitive, possibly a million years ago.
Have you heard about the sandstone outcropping in Bolivia at Lake Titicaca?
Sandstone outcroppings. I've heard about ruins up there, but not necessarily.
There's an island in Titicaca. Kathy and I haven't been able to get to it yet. It's been sealed off from the world. National Geographic paid the village a whole lot of money to keep it a secret.
Wow.
Because they want to do a story on it someday. Promised them a lot of money, and now no one can get in there unless you're an archaeologist. And of course, we aren't. So, but anyway, there's the sandstone outcropping on this small island at the southern end of Lake Titicaca. And on this piece of sandstone, there are human footprints One's wearing a moccasin, the other one's barefoot. And I've spoken to the archaeologist in charge of the place for Bolivia, and his archaeological assistant was my assistant when Kathy and I were in Bolivia a couple of years ago. And we were told exactly what this is and where it's at, and it's millions of years old. I think the figure was something like 11 million years old. And it's just sitting there. It's just being kept quiet and secreted.
This is one of the forbidden archaeology artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, this is a more modern one than the book that I'm referring to, but that concept, the Uparts and the Fortiana and all that good stuff, I've studied all that too. That's a lot of fun. There some story about a booted footprint in the Mojave, I think, and it was in some stratum that was, I'm thinking it was either 1.5 million or 15 million years old.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, these lead to all kinds of interesting speculative theories that go into a... But
yeah, I know. And the thing is, though, when you compare how recent our history is compared to that, and you have a Jesus figure within 2,000 years, that is just a sliver in time. If you start going back 1 million years, or in the case of, if you're correct, 15 million years ago, it makes me wonder who their Jesus was, what their religion was. And
well, that's what I do wonder, and why I take it back as far as I can. And here's an interesting thing to consider. If we actually could just go back 50,000 years, we can look pretty closely at what happened now with DNA spread,
mm-hmm.
coming from Africa down across the lower Asian part all the way into Indonesia, and that was the earliest, and then Australia and Polynesia. We can look at this spread and trace religious ideas that way as well. What these earlier people, 50,000 years ago, we have the Aboriginals in Australia who have some very interesting beliefs that are primitive in the sense that they are close to the source of what the wave of humanity that I'm talking about, the genetic Eve, mm-hmm. that's a specific branch of hominid that we can look at rather than what these footprints that we're discussing may have represented. That obviously we have no other information about that. There's something that could have gone on here. I don't see why not with, like I said, the cranial, if we even just look at 200,000 years ago, that Homo sapiens sapiens clearly arose, according to mainstream science now. Cranium of the same capacity as we have now. There's no reason there wouldn't be geniuses, that they could have built some extraordinary buildings, which they apparently did at least 12,000 years ago. And what has been destroyed under the water, we just don't know. It could be a massive amount of building like that. But even if we look at these emanations out of Africa that are traceable through the DNA,
mm-hmm.
we can start to go back to the earliest vestiges of religious ideas. In certain parts of Africa, water was very important because it was dry. Possibly in that southern area where the genetic Eve supposedly was, that the god of water becomes very important. And then in desert regions, the sun becomes a pestilence. It's not considered a nice god, because obviously the burning sands and it seems as if the sun is killing everything.
Mm-hmm.
If you go up to the northern regions of the western of the northern hemisphere, I should say, such like northern Europe, where it's dark much of the year and cold, then the sun coming forth in December is a time of great rejoicing.
Mm-hmm.
And the Son is then considered the great healer and the savior, the bringer of light, the god of the cosmos, the proxy of the highest, and so forth and so on. So you find these ideas changing depending on where people land, where people have ended up. In the Himalaya, you have obviously a lot of mountain gods.
Sure. And you do in South America as well.
On the sea. What's that?
You do in South America as well.
Yeah, it's fantastic mountains in South America. Yeah, it's an amazing place. But of course, there are supposedly thousands of archaeological sites there that have not been excavated. So, and they're finding stuff that's dating back 5,000, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 years in South America as well. And there is this idea that it's possible South America is really the old world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this was a kind of a laughable idea because, of course, the Europeans who came to the American continent wanted to believe they were so superior and advanced. And we still have this tude going on, I find, in the scientific world where they don't want to look at the stuff that I'm bringing forth because it attributes too much advancement to older cultures. And we can only have a linear evolution.
Well, we're going to break. Let's pick this up when we come back and open the phone lines for the callers. Folks, we'll be back right after this. Hello, everyone. And we're back. Last half hour of the show, and Acharya, we have a caller on the line, I think. Let's find out. Hello, this is Jerry on the Kevin Smith Show. You're live. Who are you, and where are you calling from? What's your name?
This is Tony from Denver.
Hello, Tony from Denver.
Hey, Jerry. Acharya, thank you for being on the show. Hopefully, I got your name right there.
Oh, hold on.
Hello?
There we go. I'm sorry. I didn't push the right button. Yeah, we can hear you now.
All right. Yeah, hi there.
Yeah, this is Tony from Denver.
Yeah, Jerry, thank you for being on the show tonight. I want to ask you about what happens to us when we die. Do you believe in reincarnation?
Well, Jerry, will you remind me that I did say I was going to talk about my DVD and my future projects, so I got to get like a decent minute of that.
All right.
Okay. Well, what I can do is give you a smorgasbord of options that have been perceived around the world over the past several thousand years by a variety of cultures, and then I can tell you what I would like to think happens when we die, but I can't obviously lay down any kind of doctrine that everybody needs to believe in. So anything that you can think of basically has been thought of for the afterlife. We have slightly different afterlife ideas in a variety of cultures, and some are more dramatically different. The reincarnation option is one, and I think there's merit to considering it. And that's why many cultures dating back into antiquity have done so. They have thought about it long and hard. And there are aspects of it, like I say, that are worth considering. For example, we hear stories about children who have remarkable tales to tell, who could never have known what they're saying, with specific details about dates and names, last and first names. Saying that there's a child who claims to have been a pilot and knew the name of his co-pilot. And very detailed, interesting stories that I like to consider. I don't just out of hand poo-poo them. At least look them over. And also our own experiences. I never try to tell anybody what their own experience is. If someone says that they like to sit on the top of a mountain peak and contemplate the concept of God and a beautiful glowing entity that pervades the cosmos and fills them with with joy. I have no problem with them doing that. It's their own business. And in fact, I've done it myself. That's why I can describe it so well. But if they also want to think that there's absolutely, could never possibly be any anthropomorphized God in charge of anything on planet Earth, that's also up to them at any given moment that they want to think like that. An atheistic thought that's logical. So.
Does that answer your question, Tony?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I had a second question if I could, Jerry.
Sure, go ahead.
Jerry, how do you feel about the idea of creation in the way it was taught to Billy Myers by the Pleiadians?
Well, I'd have to read it. I'd have to read on that, John May, Tony.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to revisit that and give you an opinion afterwards.
What about your guest, Jerry?
Well,
does she have any ideas on creation, maybe, instead of God? Would that make her feel better?
I don't feel badly. Who suggested I was feeling badly?
Well, you know, like creation, you know, I don't know, different ways to look at it.
Yeah, I've read Billy Meyer. I'm not a big fan of the whole shebang. But, yeah, there's all kinds of concepts around the world dating back thousands of years that, you know, we have God concepts, we have no God concepts, we have male gender, we have female genders, we have different colors, they all have different races. And this is what we're finding today, is a clash of cultural artifacts, basically, that are not necessarily the ultimate truth. In some cultures, the ultimate truth would be genderless, formless, colorless. You could think of it as a white light, perhaps, that permeates the cosmos.
Yeah, I think everyone creates God in their own image, wouldn't you say that?
Anthropologically speaking, that seems to be the case if we look at cultures around the world. But unfortunately, the real troubles have come when intolerant monotheistic desert creeds have swept out and taken over and destroyed other people's cultures and forced this monotheism on people against their will. And it's a very intolerant perspective, and it's created tremendous destruction, genocide. We're talking 500 million people dead between the three major monotheisms, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam.
Yeah, I know. The Spanish came into South America, as you well know, and Central America, and they had a choice, either believe or die.
Yeah. This happened all over the place. There's an estimate of 50 million people in North and South American continents who were killed from first contact.
Mm-hmm.
Not right away, obviously, but because of it.
Right.
And a lot of that had to do with the missionaries coming forth and saying these are heathen, diabolical, we have reason to kill them, get rid of them. In some instances, they were tackling some pretty rough characters like the Maya and the Aztecs. So. Anyway, hey, I wanted to quickly, before we take the next caller, if that's possible.
Well, let's finish up with Tony. Are you finished, Tony?
Sure, that'll do it for me. Thanks, Jerry. Great show.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks.
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, anyway, so I had been working on a DVD, and this will be the first one that I've released. I've done a number of videos that you can watch free online.
Mm-hmm.
And I've appeared in some documentaries and in some interviews like this. So this is going to be the Christ Conspiracy video, DVD.
Cool.
And I go into a number of these conversations, these subjects, and then it's an interview of me speaking, and then we're going to, you know, we're putting images and whatnot. This is what we're doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be coming out hopefully fairly shortly. And then I have several other books that I'm working on at the same time. One is on Islam, another is on Christmas anthology. I've got another one on God.
Mm-hmm.
These are all irons in the fire. There's quite a lot of all of them written already. And the one I'm working on now most fervently, however, is a revision of The Christ Conspiracy, which is my best-selling book. And that should be out in spring of 2012.
And where would a person go to get these items?
Stellarhousepublishing.com is one of my websites. Truthbeknown.com is another. You can also read my blog at freethoughtnation.com. Truthbeknown.com is my oldest website.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of great articles there for free you can read. I have ebooks.
Yeah.
Stuff.
Yeah, that's
new DVD.
The new DVD. I'm looking forward to it. And when you have it ready, why don't you let us know, and we'll let everyone else know about it as well.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you so kindly.
Yeah, you bet. Happy to do it. Well, we don't have any other callers right now, folks. The lines are open. Let's see. The number is 602-412-3196. If you have a question or a comment for our guest, please give a call. One of the things...
I have this other book that Christ in Egypt is a very big, thick book. I put together as much of the primary source material I could find to show the profound connections between Christianity and the Egyptian religion.
Uh-huh.
Including the figures of Osiris and Horus, and of course Isis, who is shown nursing Horus in precisely the same manner as the Madonna and child that we so commonly envision. And I show where so many Christian doctrines come from, including virgin birth and the miracles, the motif of the God with 12 followers,
mm-hmm.
The death and resurrection, the significance of the ages of 12 and 30,
we,
and the baptizer or purifier.
We have a caller on the line.
Oh, great.
Let's find out who this is. Hi, this is Jerry on the Kevin Smith Show. Your name and where are you calling from, please?
Oh, hello, Jerry. It's Haya from Victoria, Vancouver Island, British Columbia.
Well, Haya.
Hi. Is it Acharya?
Yeah, Acharya, but you Canadians say it.
Okay. Yeah, you have a lot of similar beliefs to my uncle. My uncle is now passed away, but he was living in the Middle East in Israel. And he did a lot of research and on the different digs. And, of course, he came up with a lot of the same conclusions you did, but he wasn't allowed to really put them in, because if it didn't fit in with what they're teaching today, they just put it on the side or not, they don't like to look at it.
True. And, yeah, of course, the Middle East and Israel in particular has had the whole problem of wanting to fit everything into a biblical framework.
Well, you can't do that.
Yeah, they're discovering that. You know, we have some great, courageous archaeologists in Israel, like Israel Finkelstein, who has basically wrote the Bible on Earth and basically debunked the Bible timeline, showing that it couldn't have happened the way it's depicted in the Old Testament. And
Have you listened to Andrew Collins by any chance? Have you listened to what he's come up with as far as the lining up of the pyramids of Giza?
I have read.
Well,
hold
that thought just a second. We're going to put you both on hold for just a moment and go to this next break, and we'll be back right after this.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for holding. We are coming back, folks. All right. We have Haya on the line and Acharya on the line. And
uh-huh.
You were saying, I forgot who was talking to who now. Go ahead and have the question time.
Haya, want to repeat what you were asking?
Well, I was thinking about what you were saying about Christ, and you know, I'm thinking about if you go back into history, I think a lot of the so-called Christ belief, or it might not even be Christ. It could be the Mary, or it could be even going back further. I sometimes wonder if it's people that are in contact with light beings from somewhere else, because I've been in contact with light beings, and I go every year to a special place, and I am in contact on a constant basis. And I'm just wondering if this has happened through history as well, and that's it's mistaken for something else.
Wow, good question.
Well, that would be a description of essentially of angels, right? So,
angels. No, not angels. I meant actually light beings. Some, whether it's interdimensional, whether it's extraterrestrial.
Right. So that's how people describe angels as well. You find these types of stories. The details will change, but you do find these types of stories if you look at them as angels, in particular, in say, the Bible, of course, but then in other countries.
But then when they talk about angels in the Old Testament, they're talking about people. They describe them as just like you and I.
Well, they'll come to that level, but as you go out, extend yourself back out again, when they're like disappearing in front of your very eyes, they would have existence in a different plane that is not going to be necessarily like what we see here. So when we think of angels, we're not necessarily thinking that somewhere up in the sky there's actually a physical being that's shaped like a human. We're thinking of whatever they're connected to, which is transcending form. But that also, beyond the Bible, in other cultures you will find this sort of concept of, and particularly in solar worship, the sun is the ultimate light being. And so people definitely have communed with the sun. They have thought that the sun had consciousness. And they would see it as both an entity unto itself, as well as a proxy, or almost like a focal point for the one great God that permeates the cosmos, but like a prism coming through the sun at us. And so I see no problem with people throughout history saying that they connected with light beings, because very much so that the sun and also the stars and planets as well each had their own genius, their own personality, and they were anthropomorphized just like the angels. They were given shape and form. That's why we see the god Apollo with a certain form, and the goddess Venus, whose name
I know what you're saying. I understand what you're saying. I found that I have been taking just since 2007 I've got myself into photography, and I end up taking pictures of orbs of different types, interdimensionals. That's all I can consider them, because they're so different. And on top of all this, I noticed that sometimes when I'm taking a picture with somebody else, I can actually take the picture of that person. They're almost like they're transforming into nothing almost. I mean, they're fading away in the camera, and yet you can see the background as clear as day, and they're kind of fading away. I've noticed this a number of times, and I really believe that it's human beings that can actually do these things. I think we just don't understand what we are and who we are at any given point. We've been so led astray by so many dogmas over thousands of years. It's like we're trying to wade through and figure out what's real and what's not real.
Yeah, there's just about anything you can imagine under the sun in our, let's say, history of consciousness dating back 10,000 years, the concept that you're describing. Obviously, people who are of hardcore scientific materialistic bent are not going to concur that any of these things have any sort of reality beyond our imagination. But interestingly enough, it often depends on how we choose to manifest a creative idea. For example, the Egyptians had all kinds of beliefs, like you're talking about. Their afterworld was fairly complicated. There were different hells that they went into, and purification chambers. It's extremely complicated, and there are all manner of creatures populated these various heavens and so forth.
Well, does that answer your question, Aya?
Yes, it does.
All right.
Okay.
Because we're coming up on final approach here in the next few minutes, and I want to see if we can get any other callers in. Thanks for calling, Aya.
Okay, thank you very much, Sherry, and have a good evening.
Yes, and you
both
too.
Both of you.
You know, one of the things that came to mind when she was asking those questions is we've seen paintings on cliff walls of what would easily be described, if you were to see them, as luminous beings. They're larger and they're dancing around. We have another caller. Let's see who this is. Hi, this is Jerry on Kevin Smith's show. Your name and where are you calling from, please?
Hello?
Yeah.
Hi.
You might want to turn your...
Is this the radio show?
Yeah.
Yes.
This is John in Cleveland.
Hello, John. How are you?
Okay.
You have a question?
Yeah. How many books were written before... Hello there?
Yes, hi. We hear you.
Okay, how many books similar to Acharya's books were written before the U.S. Constitution, books similar to Acharya's with the same questions and doubts as Acharya's after the U.S. Constitution? I mean, not exactly, but just approximately. Were there any books at all before the U.S. Constitution?
Yes, sir. Yeah. You're talking about the field of Jesus mysticism?
Jesus mysticism, questioning the existence of Jesus.
Yeah.
Actual full books.
Yeah, yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there were multiple volumes before the American Constitution was written. Actually, since the Constitution was worked on for a long time, what year are you talking about?
Let's say before the Constitution was completed, which what I believe was 1788. So let's say before the year 1775.
Well, around the same era as you're discussing, in France, quite independent of this country, there was the work of Count Volney and Charles Dupuy, and both of them, in fact, wrote mysticist books. Dupuis was multiple volumes in French. And Count Volney, as it so happens, was a friend of Thomas Jefferson, who actually translated his mysticist book into English. So there's this incredible connection going on between this movement in France and the founding of the United States, no doubt about that. So, the ability to think for ourselves has something to do with this development of this information. But it was also coming out of the Greek school in Europe.
Folks, we're at the end of the show.
Thank you
for your call. Acharya, I want to thank you for being our guest this evening.
Yes, it was a pleasure.
It was a pleasure for me as well, and I know our listeners were enjoying this. Time has just blown past. I'm sorry for all the commercial breaks, but those are necessary. But fantastic information.